Lake Okeechobee causing a scare, and we recognize a MacArthur Genius Grant winner. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, the water level at Lake Okeechobee rose significantly during Hurricane Irma. It didn't hit the record, but federal officials are checking the Herbert Hoover Dyke daily to make sure that it's holding strong. Greg Asbett has been fighting for farm workers' rights for decades. He recently was named a recipient of the so-called Genius Grant from the MacArthur Foundation. He'll talk to us about a career helping folks without a voice defend themselves. Then we'll sit and talk with Richard J. Alexander. He's directed some of the biggest hits on Broadway, and he's worked with stars including Barbara Streisand and Bette Midler. All of that coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. First, the news. Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks for listening. Well, Lake Okeechobee is essential to the ecosystem of Florida. We all know that. It feeds the Everglades, and of course, it creates numerous economic opportunities, but it also creates a danger to the communities that exist along the waters. That became dangerously obvious in the weeks after Hurricane Irma as the water levels in the lake rose to above 17 feet. Now, the record is 18.5 feet, but we're getting close. The Herbert Hoover Dyke is already undergoing a $1.7 billion reinforcement. It's going to take another 8 years to finish, though. Governor Scott wants the federal government to speed up the process. WLRN's Peter Hayden visited parts of the dyke recently, and he joins us now via Skype. Peter, welcome to the program.
Hey, Lewis. Thanks for having me.
You were out at the dyke. You were there with the Army Corps of Engineers. They're out there almost daily, right, doing inspections, and you visited the glades, some of the communities there. Tell us a little bit about how people living there feel and what they're saying about these questions and these issues over the dike's weaknesses.
Yeah, well, they're freaked out. They're freaked out because the water level of the lake is at its highest point since Hurricane Wilma in 2005. It's above 17 feet, which is kind of a trigger level for the Army Corps to do daily inspections, as you mentioned. And so people who are living around the lake have been watching the water from the rains that raked through with Hurricane Irma has slowly now made its way through the streams and tributaries in the watershed and been filling up the lake like a bathtub. And so now with the high water level, the real concern that people have around the Glades communities is what if we had another storm come through? So we're still, 5 weeks out from the end of hurricane season, Lewis, and people there are concerned. The level is high at 17 feet. The Army Corps has not found any structural issues with the dike, so that's very good. But people are concerned, what if another storm comes through, you know?
You know what, and I have to mention, too, that I grew up in Clewiston, and that's that little town there south of Lake Okeechobee. It's out there with a lot of those other places, Belglade and Pahokee. And anybody who's driven through that area, you're driving along the road, and there's just this big hill. It looks like a rolling hill, but it's a pretty big hill. What you may not realize is on the other side is Lake Okeechobee. That's the dike that's protecting all of these communities and, of course, a lot of agriculture from that lake just spilling out over everything. Let's talk about the Army Corps of Engineers. As you said, they are doing daily checks now. When they're checking, what are they looking for exactly?
Well, I just want to clarify that real quick. The level of the lake has now dropped to 16.94 feet. There's going to be a lot of numbers in our conversation here today. But it's dropped just below 17 feet. That means that the Corps has scaled back those daily inspections now to twice a week. So currently, now the Corps is inspecting the southern half of the lake twice a week. I'd just like to talk a little bit about why the Corps takes the southern half, has a special focus on that. And that's because the elevation at the southern end of Lake Okeechobee is actually lower than the elevation at the northern end, slightly lower. And so if you can imagine having a bathtub, and if you drop one end of that bathtub slightly down, the water then pushes up against that side and puts greater force on that end of the bathtub. Well, that's the lake. That's Lake Okeechobee on the southern end. It's dropped down just slightly, so the pressure is greater on the southern side of the lake. So,
and so when the Army Corps of Engineers going around checking it, and again, this is the dike's been around decades. I believe it's close to 80 years old now.
Right.
What are they looking for exactly? In those checks, and if they find a hole or if they find an issue, how do they plug that up?
Right. So they look for what's called seepage. Basically, it's water that kind of seeps through the dike. The dike itself is an earthen dam. It's made of earth, rock, and other material that was used from the area here that was built up. So it's not it's been reinforced over the years, but it's primarily an earthen dam. So when you have that, if you can imagine, like, I guess, building a sandcastle at the beach, what they look for is the seepage. So if you had a sandcastle and you saw a little bit of water trickling through the foundation of your sandcastle, that might be okay. But if you started to see that water bringing with it a lot of sand and shells and other material, that's the concern. And that's what the Army Corps is looking for. They're looking for evidence that the seepage is bringing with it material that it actually makes up the dike. So it's actually bringing with it, part of the dike, and therefore weakening the integrity of the dike and the ability for it to hold the lake back. They did not, the Corps has not found any issues of concern with the structural integrity of the dike. They did find 8 areas of seepage when they were doing these daily inspections along the southern half of the dike. They didn't have to do any remediation of these seepage areas, but if they did, they have material in place that they can plug these seepage areas with, and they even have some very advanced technology that involving rubber and some polymers that can expand and so on. But they have a plan in place. But they didn't have to do that remediation at this time.
Again, we're talking with WLRN's own Peter Hayden. He was recently out at Lake Okeechobee at the Herbert Hoover Dike. Again, water had risen up above 17 feet, but as he had mentioned, it has dropped down a little bit now these past few days, but still dangerously high, that it's got the Army Corps of Engineer inspecting the dike regularly to make sure, as he's talked about, that there isn't this seepage, that there isn't any damage being done to the dike. And there are people living along that dike who are concerned because, again, this is the dike that was created after the 1928 hurricane that flooded out the area and killed over 3,000 people. The dike is put there to protect those communities. Peter, wanted to go to the fact that the governor now has asked for the federal government to increase the money being spent and to speed up the process, I should say, in fixing the dike. Was the plan to rebuild it or just strengthen it? What exactly was the plan that is not going to be finished until the mid-2020s?
Right. Well, as you mentioned, so the governor and very much the people around in the communities around the Glades have asked the federal government to expedite the funding for the rehabilitation and repair of the Herbert Hoover Dike. The project is now scheduled to be completed in 2025. That's 8 years from now. The governor would like to see that cut down to 5 years to be fixed by 2022. I don't have all the details of exactly what those repairs entail, but they involve installing culverts, certain drainage options that the Corps could turn on and off to kind of regulate the water level better and to reinforce the integrity of the dike. So the push now, particularly by the state of Florida, is they want to see the federal government expedite these funds, which would take about $200 million a year, Lewis, for the next 5 years. historically, since this reinforcement project has been going on over the last decade, or it's been going on for 10 years, the funding that has come down from the federal government has been between $50 million and $150 million a year. So they're hoping that they can get $200 million a year now.
So you had the opportunity to spend some time there and, you know, visit some of these communities. Where did you go?
I spent time in South Bay, in Belglade, and in Pahokee, and I was in Clewiston as well.
And you know what did you get? What sense did you get from the people who live there? Because, you know, they depend on the lake in part because of course, fishing. And that's business because that's also tourism. But what's their relationship to the lake? What sense did you get of the relationship people have to Lake Okeechobee, considering, again, these towns are right up next to the lake?
Right. I mean, the lake is kind of part of the identity of the area. They're proud of their marinas and their lakefront properties. A lot of people live quite close to that hill and berm that you were talking about that surrounds the lake. Particularly in Pahokee, there are a lot of really nice houses and it's beautiful, but it's dangerous. It's dangerous also. And so people...
But how did they live with that danger? How did they live with that threat?
It's a concern for them, you know, and it's fearful, particularly when the lake is this high. And so they live in a state of you know, hoping that nothing happens to the dike. And many of them live with the institutional memory of the 1928 hurricane that you mentioned. Not that they remember it from their own personal experience, but from their family experience. And many of them have family members that either survived or were killed by that 1928 hurricane. So it looms. It looms in sort of the identity and it defines the area in a way.
You know, and there is actually a book. There's a classic novel, the book "Their Eyes Were Watching God" by Zora Neale Hurston, and it's you know, again, about the storm that went it overtopped the lake, and it caused this catastrophic flooding, and again, drowning almost a few thousand people in that area, especially around Belglade and those nearby towns. You think about it now; a lot more people live in that area. You have a lot of agriculture. You have so much industry going on there. Could something that bad happen again? Are federal officials worried about that?
Yeah, they are. And the people that live around there also are. Now, that would be an extreme case for sure. And I don't want to make it sound like that, you know, is imminent by any means. But that's what people are concerned about. That's why the federal government is spending $1.7 billion dollars, make sure I have my math right, on fixing the dike, because people are very concerned that's a possibility if the lake, you know, rises up because of a lot of rainfall in the area, and then we get a massive storm.
And it was Hurricane Irma that brought in almost, it helped the lake rise almost, what, 3 feet, right?
Right.
Just during that one storm. So, you know, again, coming back to this question of, you know, living in that under that threat during Hurricane Irma, the governor actually had evacuated some of those areas because there was the concern that, again, massive flooding could be a risk to some of those communities. What have you heard from state officials about, you know, if the water were to rise again and they could not flush a lot of it out? Because, again, there are ways to do that, both, you know, along two different river routes, canal routes, I should say, going east and west. But is there a question of ever evacuating towns again if that's the scenario, that they would have to do that?
Yeah, that's exactly the plan, as I understand it. I asked the Florida Department of Division of Emergency Management if that's kind of the plan going forward. And that is the plan, to evacuate those glades areas until they feel that the integrity of the dike is no longer an issue. And so if, you know, they evacuated the entire southern half of the lake, the governor of Florida, Governor Rick Scott, issued a mandatory evacuation for the entire southern region of the lake a day before Hurricane Irma hit. I think it was the 8th, which was Friday. And so all those people had to scramble to get out. And we're talking, Lewis, as you know, about the area of Florida, which has the highest unemployment rate as a region, hovers around 25% in the Glades. And so this isn't a wealthy community. There are people who are living day, you know, paycheck to paycheck, day to day. And that was really, really traumatic for them and caused a lot of hardship, that evacuation. But that is the plan going forward until the dike is strong enough.
Again, talking with WLRN's Peter Hayden, you can check out his reporting on Lake Okeechobee and the issues with the Herbert Hoover Dike at WLRN.org. He joined us via Skype. Peter, it's always a pleasure, man. Thanks so much.
Hey, thanks for having me, Lewis.
All right, coming up, we're going to meet one of this year's MacArthur Fellows, a man who has been fighting for farm worker rights. That's next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The coalition of Immokalee workers made headlines some years ago when it stood up against large companies like Taco Bell, Burger King, and Publix. They were fighting for a penny more per pound of tomatoes picked by the workers in Immokalee. And for the most part, they won. The group has fought against human trafficking and violence against workers. This year, Greg Asbed, co-founder of the CIW, is one of the recipients of the so-called Genius Grant from the MacArthur Foundation for his work in this area over the decades. He's been working alongside farm workers to win basic rights, and now he's taken that fight to other communities around the world. Now, it looks like we had him on the phone, and it looks like, did we lose him? I think we did. We're going to try to get him back here in just a moment. And again, just coming back to what the Coalition of Immokalee Workers does, a group in Immokalee that since the early 90s has been working to help farm workers. Some of these folks are undocumented residents. Many of them are not. And the coalition basically has worked to help fight, again, not only human trafficking, but just to get the workers basic rights, to get the help workers have a voice in this community and in the industry. Again, Greg Asbed is the co-founder, and he was again mentioned this year, named this year as the Genius Grant winner from the MacArthur Foundation. Let's see. I think that we have him back. I'm going to see if he's there. Mr. Asbed, are you there?
I am here. Sorry about that. I don't know how that happened, but yes, I am here.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate your time. And again, congratulations on winning this grant. Did you learn about social justice, you know, in your childhood?
I suppose I did. My family has a fairly unique history. I'm a first-generation Armenian-American. My father came here from Syria, where he was born, when my grandmother was moved from Turkey to Syria as part of the Armenian genocide. And she was 13 at the time of the genocide and saw her family killed, with the exception of her sister. And she managed to reach safety by being bought and sold twice at that age to...
Mr. Asbed, I apologize. It looks like we're having just a little bit of issue with the phone line. I'm going to try to plow through this, but if at any point we may try to reconnect with you. But you talk about your grandmother and the experience that she had in the Armenian genocide. Did she or your parents tell you about that? Did they talk about it a lot? All right. It looks like we are having problems with that line. We're going to try to reconnect here with you, Mr. Asbed. I do apologize about that. I'm not sure what's happening with the line. But again, I've been talking with Greg Asbed. He's a co-founder of the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, and this year he was named the recipient of, again, the so-called Genius Grant from the MacArthur Foundation for his work that he's done now, again, since the early 90s, working to fight for and protect the rights of farm workers. Many of these folks who have found themselves here, come here from so many different countries and locations, many of them don't know the laws, don't know life here, except just looking for work. Many of them don't even speak the language. And he has fought to win them at least basic rights, basic human rights. We had just some technical difficulties. Hopefully we'll get him back up on the line. Is he there? Let's go ahead. I'm going to try one more time here. Okay, nope, he's not there yet. So we'll get to it in just a moment. Again, I do apologize about that. Just had a bad phone line. That's all it is. But I do want to continue the conversation with him. He actually was just mentioning, too, that he has relatives who were victims of part of the Armenian genocide. And I wanted to ask him a little bit about that in his life. Let's see if we do have him again now. Mr. Azbett, are you there? Okay. All right. We'll get this straight. Sometimes technology just doesn't help us out.
You know what? Here in Immokalee.
Well, you know what? I wanted to come back, and we were talking about. I wanted to know: did your family talk to you about the experiences they had? During the Armenian genocide.
We did. I mean, you know, one of the things about genocide survivors is that often they kind of keep the details of their experience to themselves, you know. My grandmother was 13, a young woman at that time, and I'm quite sure that having known the stories out of the genocide, that much more happened to her than she ever shared. But we did, you know, we did talk about the big trajectory of the story. And so in the sense, my father would always tell me, if you meet any Kurds, always welcome them into your home. Always, you know, give them whatever you have, because they're the reason we're here. And the reason that's the case is because Kurds bought my grandmother from the Turks in the course of a death march, and then sold her again to the Armenian family that was my grandfather's family. So in that sense, our family has always had a connection to the Kurdish people that essentially we're here because of them. So that sort of thing is something that runs pretty deep in your mind when you're young and growing up in the United States, where you can hardly imagine that sort of situation. But just the sense that you know, universal human rights are something that this country, the world, really came to after World War II. You know, after the Holocaust, after the senseless death of millions and millions of soldiers. Fighting fascism, the idea that there are certain universal human rights that everyone at birth is endowed with, and that those rights can't be taken away by the state or by any other individual or by any corporation, and that those rights are precious and should be protected. That is something I have always believed as long as I can remember.
Your first human rights work was in Haiti, I believe. What were you doing there?
Well, after I graduated from college, I went to Haiti to work in development in the countryside. And I ended up working with a peasant movement there that after the fall, I was there from 1985 to 1988. So many of your listeners may know the history of Haiti and know that that included the end of the Duvalier regime, the 28 years of Duvalier dictatorship, which was in 1986, and then the effort under the military junta that took over after Duvalier left to implement democracy in that country, a country that had not had a history of democracy. And so it was an eye-opening 3 years in my life. And there was a lot of remarkably courageous struggle, some incredible techniques of organizing and educating and building awareness in communities of people, many of whom are not literate, or who live in the countryside and never had a chance to go to school, and yet just powerful methods of organizing and education to help people learn what it is to what a democracy is. And what the role of each citizen in that democracy is, and how to protect their rights in that situation. And that experience, definitely was one of the roots of the development of the Coalition of Immokalee Workers.
And we talk about that coalition, and I wanted to know, from the time after you left Haiti, at what point did you start working with American farm workers, and how did you start that work?
Well, I was back up in where I grew up in the Washington, D.C. area after coming back from Haiti. And my wife, Laura Gimeno, who heads up our anti-slavery work here, she had gotten involved with farm workers first before I did in Pennsylvania. And she came across a case of a situation where Haitian workers were in some very bad conditions, horrible housing, horrible labor conditions, and sub-minimum wage pay. And she needed help with translation. So she recruited me, dragged me into the job, and it was just a fascinating look into the conditions that 99% of consumers really don't know about that exist hidden just beneath the surface of our country's trillion-dollar food industry. I didn't know about it at the time, but I learned about it pretty quickly, and it was also very eye-opening.
You came to Immokalee in the early 90s. What brought you there?
To work in this field of working with farm workers and trying to improve conditions, labor conditions for workers. And so I came down, my wife and I came down to work with a local legal services organization, which helps farm workers who don't have the money to hire attorneys when they're in situations and they need to defend their legal rights. And from there, we came into communication with workers here in Immokalee who also had experiences like mine in Haiti. Some incredible organizers from Haiti that came in the early 90s in that second wave of Haitian refugees to the country after the President Aristide was overthrown. In fact, some people with whom I worked in Haiti directly suddenly showed up in Immokalee and were just trying to get their feet under them and work in the fields. And we've run into each other here in town, and we realized, hey, we have some skills, we have some experience and techniques, and we've worked together before, and we know how to try to help communities think about the problems they're facing and find the roots of those problems and try to fix those problems by getting at them at the roots. And why don't we try to do that here? And so we did. We started the process of convening community meetings here in Immokalee for people who are interested, and started to discuss, what is it that makes farm workers so poor? Why is it that farm workers face some of the most brutal labor conditions in the country? What are the reasons for those things, and what can we do about them?
Again, I'm talking with Greg Asbed, co-founder of the Coalition of Immokalee Workers and the recent recipient of the so-called Genius Grant from the MacArthur Foundation. Again, working in the Coalition of Immokalee Workers now for almost 25 years, fighting for the rights of farm workers. We're going to continue this conversation in a moment here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez, and I'm talking with Greg Asbed, co-founder of the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, and again, this year's recipient of the Genius Grant from the MacArthur Foundation. Mr. Asbed, I was talking to you a moment ago about when you arrived in Immokalee, and, over the years, we've heard all these stories about the conditions for many of the workers, especially out in the tomato fields, because that's a big crop in the part of Florida that you're in, and that's really actually just west of where we are. We've heard stories of crews doing slave labor, not being paid, not being able to leave, but really kind of help us understand some of the things, especially that you saw when you first arrived there.
Sure. Although let me start by saying that the great news is that those abuses, conditions that we saw when we first got here are no longer the case in the Florida tomato industry. It's probably gone from one of the toughest, harshest industries for farm labor conditions in the country to now the most progressive industry in the country today. So that's a great trajectory, a great story. We're extremely proud, and that's the work of the Fair Food Program. But it wasn't like that when we first got here. When we got to Immokalee, there were And one of the first things we came across was people working against their will, forced by violence.
Oh, you know what? Hold on one second. That's a technical issue we have here. Let me see if I can fix that. Oh, we are just having phone problems all day long today. All right, we're going to try to get Mr. Asbed back up on the line. I do apologize about that. Again, my guest is Greg Asbed. He is the co-founder of the Coalition of Immokalee Workers and, again, one of the recipients of the so-called Genius Grant from the MacArthur Foundation. And, again, for his work that he had spent decades now, really almost 25 years, working for farm worker rights in South Florida, especially. Immokalee is a small little town, by the way. If you haven't been to it, it's really almost due west of Miami-Dade County. It is located about 30, 35 minutes from Fort Myers, and a small little community that actually grows in size by almost five times its size when the season starts. All right, now I do have him back, so I'm going to get him in here. Mr. Asbed, I do apologize about the technical issues, but as you were saying, you were talking about, you had mentioned that so many of the terrible things that we had heard about the treatment of workers, especially tomato workers, really no longer the case. But you saw some horrible things when you first got here.
Right. This area used to be called Ground Zero for modern day slavery by federal prosecutors. So that'll give you an idea of just how bad things were. You know, slavery doesn't exist in a vacuum. Right? When you have forced labor in a field, it's because there's a generally degraded labor environment that allows that sort of extreme to take root, right? And so the general environment in agriculture when we first got here was you would see systemic minimum wage violations, you know, where workers, you know, thousands of workers were cheated out of minimum wage by employers who would not keep accurate hours in order to not have to pay, you know, minimum wage on all the hours that the workers were in the field. You would see absolutely, you know, the most horrendous conditions. And we hear a lot out of Hollywood today, and it's great that story has broken about sexual harassment and sexual assault. Hollywood is able to bring attention to those problems, but those problems exist elsewhere as well. Basically, they are a problem caused by an imbalance of power in a workplace. And there's no place that the imbalance of power was greater than in the fields here in Immokalee back before we started the Fair Food Program. And so women in the field face the most horrific environment of fear and intimidation and sexual harassment and sexual assault. Four out of five women report, farm worker women report facing those sorts of conditions at work. So, you know, everything from wage theft to sexual violence against women to even forced labor was sort of the nature of farm labor in Immokalee and around Florida back in the early 90s.
I wanted to ask you about the campaign that you guys had. It was this breakthrough idea that not only you wanted to negotiate with farmers who employed these farm workers, you wanted to go after their customers, the grocery stores and the fast food chains, and you had the penny per pound campaign basically asking so many of these big companies, the Burger Kings, the Taco Bells, the Publixes, and so forth, to add that extra penny per pound of tomatoes. Again, workers, so people don't understand, is that they are paid per bucket of tomatoes they pick. And that's, you know, that's their daily wage. And so you added that extra penny per pound just for a little more fairness. Some companies said yes pretty quickly. Others fought you. But really, where did that idea come from?
Well, you know, we spent many years trying, not fully in vain, but not getting the results that we had hoped for, and trying to confront face-to-face the forces that we see here immediately in the community of Immokalee. And that would, you know, the forces that we saw that were doing the sexual harassment, that were doing the forced labor, or that were doing the systemic wage theft, were the crew leaders and the growers here. And so we tried, as any sort of community organization would, to confront them and force them to come to the table and talk to us about improving those conditions, right? Making the industry a more modern, more humane place to work. But But it's very difficult for farm workers to do that for a number of reasons. And so after nearly 10 years of efforts, and, you know, which included community-wide strikes and marches across the state from Fort Myers to Orlando, even a 30-day hunger strike by six of our members, we realized the limitations of that. And we also, as a result, realized that, in fact, the sub-poverty wages and the inhumane working conditions were the roots of those things were not simply here in town. They were not something that we could see fully here in front of us. That in fact, the forces that created farm worker poverty originated at the top of the food industry, at the very top of these massive consolidated food chains like McDonald's and Walmart and Burger King, that has so much buying power of thousands of restaurants, that they're able to leverage that buying power and demand impossibly low prices for the products that they buy and sell to the public.
I want to come back to, by the way, because I had remembered covering some of those stories, but you know what? I was curious. Did it ever get resolved with Publix?
Publix has yet to even speak with us, even respond to anything that we've letters or anything else that we've sent them. No, it has not. But 14 companies have. And to their credit, they are now part of changing the face of agriculture in this country. Publix is not. Publix is holding on to whatever idea they have about the 20th century agriculture and how it should continue into this century. But the companies that are doing the right thing realize that, you know, once we made the case and we educated consumers, and consumers, you know, made sure that those companies understood that they wanted them as their consumers to do the right thing by workers in their supply chain, they realize that it is possible to leverage that same purchasing power, not to drive prices down at the farm gate and therefore wages down for farm workers in the field, because that's how growers, the only way growers could actually maintain, you know, smaller and smaller margin, but rather to use that wealth and that power that they have at the top of the food system to help improve farm worker wages rather than impoverish them, and demand compliance with certain fundamental human rights from their suppliers or not buy from them. And so using that power by conditioning their purchases on compliance with human rights, those 14 companies that have joined the Fair Food Program have created a new model for the protection of fundamental human rights and corporate supply chains that is being studied and replicated around the world today. Publix, on the other hand, remains on the wrong side of history.
I wanted to finish with this. I do remember having covered the coalition and life in Immokalee. You don't want a lot of attention on you, and a lot of the people within the coalition. It's not about any one individual. It's attention on the coalition itself. But this is a big recognition, and I just wondered for you, what does it mean to be called a Genius Grant winner?
It's uncomfortable. Exactly, because of what you said. You know, one of the secrets of our success is the fact that we believe that every single member of this organization is a leader. And we don't just believe that in theory, we believe it in practice. And so, you know, thousands of people have contributed immeasurably to the success that we've achieved as an organization. Awards, most awards by their nature are focused on the individual. And in this case, there's something of a disconnect between the two. But we're going to take this award and we're going to use it to, you know, the funds that come from it, I'm passing on to the organization because that's where they came from, essentially. You know, the award wasn't won by an individual. And so the funds that come from it don't go to an individual. They go back to the organization. And we're going to use it to expand our work and to sustain our work. So we're going to make this work for us the way we usually do, which is as a community fighting to improve our lives.
Greg Asbett, again, co-founder of the Coalition of Immokalee Workers and one of the recipients this year of the so-called Genius Grant from the MacArthur Foundation. Mr. Asbett, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Lewis.
Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Jewish Museum of Florida, FIU, is launching a new series called A Conversation With. And their first guest is director-producer Richard J. Alexander. He's been a performer, director, producer for Broadway shows and concerts. He's worked with names like Bette Midler, Bernadette Peters, and Barbara Streisand. The talk is tomorrow. That's Thursday the 26th from 7 to 9. J. Alexander will also be joined by Lee Brian Schrager. Mr. J. Alexander, a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today.
I'm happy to be here. I was wondering after that last segment how we would segue, and I'm happy to tell you my Broadway debut, which was in 1978, was made with Luis Valdez in a play called Zoot Suit, which played the Winter Garden on Broadway. And they founded El Teatro Campesino, which was the Cesar Chavez and the farm workers, the United Farm Workers. And they started this theater troupe, and that's where that play came from. And I got to be part of it because an actor did not want to come from Los Angeles, where it was a big hit. And I made my Broadway debut. And being of Latin descent, but Spanish and Cuban, and they're all running around going, orale, orale. I'm like, what the hell's going on? But it was an amazing group of people and actors. Edward James Olmos starred in it.
You know what? Usually I have to do the segues, but it's nice every now and then when the guest does
it for me. Well, it was such a serious subject, I just thought, Wow, you know, some levity, but it's just so interesting that was my Broadway debut.
Well, I do appreciate that, and because I wanted to ask you about that. It was 1978.
1978, yeah. It had been a huge hit in Los Angeles. They were leaving beer bottles in the parking lots and stuff, and I went, oh, I don't know, Broadway. The Winter Garden is where Mame was, Funny Girl, you know, and there was this big, important play, and it just had a huge revival in Los Angeles, but it's a huge part of my career, you know.
How do you describe to somebody what a Broadway debut feels like? For a young person who wants to break in the biz, I mean...
Okay, you want to make me cry?
Okay, come on, let's go.
Wow, there's nothing like it. You know, your whole life, you dream about it. You watch people on television, you watch the Tonight Show, Broadway shows, and there you are at the Winter Garden, and you fly your parents to New York. You know, I didn't grow up around money or anything. My parents were not in show business, and you bring them in a limo, and you take them to Sardi's, and it was pretty exciting. It's very funny. Every time you have a milestone in a career, you ask God to let you live till the opening night, and you say you'll never ask for anything again. And of course, the next time you do the same thing. But you do, like, you just, you know, and then you say, I can die now. And of course you can. I was like 4 years old. It's an interesting thing, and it never gets old. It just never gets old, and your Broadway family just expands, you know?
When did you go from performing to really more focusing on directing?
That's a great question. When I was in Amadeus on Broadway, I was part of the original cast, and a friend of mine who was a company manager said, get the second ASM contract. You collect the valuables, you sit in on understudy rehearsals, you do the auditions. And I was fascinated by the machinations. So when the tours were coming up, I asked, do you think the producers and Sir Peter Hall and William Morris and the National Theatre of Great Britain would ever approve me? And they did. And that was the turnaround. And then Cameron McIntosh saw one of the productions I did that was playing at the Mervish's Theater in Canada, and he asked to meet me, and the rest is sort of history, but I loved the machinations. I enjoyed acting, and you still use all your tools today, you know, singing, you know, exhibiting for performers, but they're stars and I'm not. So I love the work, you know, but I loved, you know, it was the old days, typing on a typewriter, Peter Schaffer pulling out a paper and a carbon and giving one to Ian McKellen and one to Tim Curry and, you know, here, try the scene, die Amadeus, die, and work. I mean, I was fascinated. You know, this is long before faxes and, you know, FedEx, and you know, you were doing it. You were making theater. It was pretty exciting.
And but all right, so then really, how do you compare what it's like today? You know, I was watching, you're on your phone. You're not doing the typewriter thing anymore. You're pretty good at the thumbs thing with the phone.
It's different. You know, like I say to people, like when I teach, for example, or lecture, when I went to New York, there were hundreds of us. It was a calling. You know, people today, there's contests, there's YouTube. People go, do you have any advice for my grandson? He's so talented. Well, no, actually, he's not, you know. If you're meant to do it, you'll do it. You'll chase it. You will chase your dream. Then there's the unfortunate part of the equation where people say, oh, it didn't happen for somebody till they were 40-something. But what day do you realize you don't have talent? That's another part of the equation. It's very, you know, it's so complicated now. And now I think there's thousands, if not hundreds of thousands. People love red carpet, endorsements, deals, you know, blah. And, you know, we did the work. I may be musically insane. I may be a crazy person, but I know my Shakespeare, my Ibsen, my Shaw. I'm educated, you know. And so I trained. I trained really hard. But you're also talking to somebody that all his dreams came true and more. So, you know, I continue to be amazed by my own good fortune. I've got the goods. I'm very aware of that. But, you know, timing, being at the mercy of other people, you know, making decisions, it still fascinates me, and I'm still very grateful.
All right, so then you go from the acting then to the directing. When and how did you get into the recording studio?
The recording studio happened via cast albums. That's a great question. So you were in a recording studio making Broadway cast albums. It was when I met a guy named Jay Landers, who worked with Barbara Streisand, but we did a couple of cast albums at Columbia. And he said to Barbara and to Marty Ehrlichman, you got to meet this guy. Prior to that, Bernadette Peters asked me to do her Carnegie Hall concert. That was in 1996. And that changed my entire life. You know, doing that career concert with her, people came chasing after me. We got a rave review in the New York Times. We got Grammy nominated for the original cast recording, Bernadette Peters Live at Carnegie Hall, Sondheim, etc. It was a tumbleweed. And I was like, I was floored by, you know, you pick up the phone. Hi, this is Bette Midler. Who is this really? It's Bette Midler. Will you talk to me? I mean, you know, how did you get my phone number, Donny Osmond? It's, my life is crazy, but I wouldn't change one thing about it. And I still love it. Like, I'm not jaded. I definitely have opinions. You know, I'm going to be 65 in 8 months, chasing that Medicare, just chasing it, doing all my research. Part B, like, I'm so confused. But I still love it. I love my life.
What was it like? So Bernadette Peters, the first really big name that you're working with,
yeah,
on, you know, huge. Again, in the studio. What's it like? You look at this list of people you've worked with, but yeah, just the names that I had mentioned, Bette Midler, yeah, Bernadette, yeah, Peters, Barbara Streisand.
There's so many more, even the men.
Yeah, and the men.
This Diva Whisperer thing is freaking me out because I work with so many great guys. But I'll take it. I'll take it for now for this chapter.
What was it like? What was it like, though, at that stage of your life? And all of a sudden now you work with one person. It opens all these doors. But, you know, these are highly successful people.
Yeah.
Why would they listen to you? What do they need
you
for?
Yeah, that's a great question. Why? I don't know. I
not
think
to
it's,
say you're very talented.
No,
I'm just,
it's the work ethic. It's you go to work. If you're dazzled by the stardom, you'll never get anywhere. But you go to work every day, and you got to be prepared. That doesn't mean on paper. It means it's a negotiation. It's a skill. It's a looking for opportunities. It's a dialogue. It's very hard to explain to people. I mean, people are mean. You know, once they said, oh, you direct Barbara Streisand. Really? Does she know that? I mean, that's enough to knock you over. That's a punch. But the point is, they're not me. They're not. They can't possibly comprehend, you know, what going to work is like, you know. And the guy who's interviewing me tomorrow night, Lee Schrager, we've been friends for over 30 years, and he has watched my career over these years. And we met through Charlie Cinnamon, the press agent who left us last year. He knows. He's watched my career, so it's going to be very interesting. I don't know what he's going to ask me. We met for dinner, and I just said, you know what, just throw it at me. So tomorrow night's going to be interesting, and I've fallen in love with the Jewish Museum of Florida, you know, FIU. I went there to see the Queen of Lincoln Road exhibit, and that's when the girls approached me, and so, but it's weird. It's just weird, all this attention. The Diva Whisperer thing has my brains blown out. It really does.
And I didn't mention it.
No, because listen, I've worked with Ricky Martin. I've worked with Brian Stokes Mitchell, Norm Lewis, Johnny Matt. You know, there's a lot of great men.
Let's finish on this. When you look back on your career and everything you've done, you still got plenty of time to go, lots to do. But how do you view your career? Or do you even look back on it?
You don't until moments like this when you see it stockpiled, like the achievements. It's really weird. I'm proud of it, and I wouldn't change anything, but I could never have imagined. It's like I said, opening night of Zoot Suit, I was ready to go. Like, I thought that was the dream, and then Amadeus, and then Song and Dance, and then Les Mis, and Phantom, and Saigon. What are the chances? I mean, I came from a town so little, you can't even believe it, on the outskirts of Syracuse. And, you know, my parents were Latino. My father was Spanish. My mom was Cuban. I didn't even know my mother had an accent until friends came over from high school and go, how do you understand her? Like, I didn't even get that.
Again, I'm talking with Richard J. Alexander, director, producer, and he is going to be at a special talk at the Jewish Museum of Florida, FIU. They're launching a new series called A Conversation With. Again, that's tomorrow, Thursday the 26th from 7 to 9. We'll have more information on our website, WLRN.org. Richard J. Alexander, it's been a pleasure, man.
What
Thank
a pleasure.
So
I'm a fan. Congratulations on the show. Well, I like being here. Thanks.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. And unfortunately, we're out of time, so I have to end it on that note.
There you go.
Coming up tomorrow, we're going to get another update from Puerto Rico, and also we're going to look into the black market for gator hides. You know, there's a black market in Florida for this. That's all coming up tomorrow on Sundial. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Talk to you tomorrow.